All right, so we're back with Mark Emery, also affectionately known as the Prince of Pot. He's also the publisher of Cannabis Culture magazine, the leader of the BC Marijuana Party, and a man who wears many hats. Hello, Mark.
Hey, but they're all hats of liberty and justice.
Hey.
So, you've been quite the apple of the eye of the media lately, considering all the stuff that's been going down with the DEA. Do you want to maybe inform?
Well, it's extraordinary in the one sense. So I'm glad to see that the media can reflect a genuinely serious political crisis in the country and give it a lot of airplay. What's going on is I've sold seeds, and let me give you this story. I've sold seeds for 11 years, every day of my life for the last 11 years.
That's marijuana seeds.
And marijuana seeds, oh, of course. And the idea of that was, you know, and I was determining in the early 1990s, I've been an activist since 1980 for all sorts of civil rights, civil liberties concerns, an incredible range of them that I've challenged in court, gone to jail for, and what have you. And in 1990, I got frustrated because I thought, geez, marijuana has been illegal for three or four generations. How are we going to move this up so that marijuana becomes legal in my lifetime? And I thought what we had to do is accelerate the entire process by which the confrontation occurs, by which the development of a revolutionary movement occurs. So I decided that we would sell seeds to as many people in the world as possible. In other words, we'd grow so much marijuana that I believed it would be futile for the RCMP and the DEA and police agencies around the world to try and exterminate and eradicate them all, and that we would so overgrow the government, which became our slogan everywhere, that it would be futile for them to spend millions and then billions of dollars trying to eradicate marijuana when it was not even going to be possible to do so. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, we'd distribute all these seeds to everyone, and everybody would grow marijuana, and they'd become self-sufficient in their own supply, and they wouldn't have to buy in the black market, and Americans wouldn't have to go to the inner city to buy marijuana, and medical people could be self-sufficient and have their own. We'd have hundreds of different varieties. It would empower people to grow marijuana, and we'd overgrow the U.S. drug war, and ultimately the administrations of the presidency that are pushing these punitive wars against us. And it's all to me a persecution akin to what happens to the Falun Dafa people or Falun Gong people in China. We're exercising a peaceful, honest lifestyle that harms no one, that is a choice we make of a spiritual enlightenment nature that's very similar to vegetarianism, Christianity, Falun Gong, yoga, and any of these other peaceful, honest lifestyles that don't impact directly on any other individual. And then when everybody was growing all this marijuana from these seeds that I sent, and they would send me the money for them, and I would use that money, give it away, and in fact, I gave away over $4 million, or a little under $4 million in 11 years, to all these different activist groups and projects that were peaceful, democratic agents of change. So we paid for the Supreme Court case, ballot initiatives in Arizona, Washington, Alaska. We paid to get people out of jail. We paid for their lawyers. We paid for conferences in town here beyond prohibition. We paid for marijuana parties all over the world, as far away as Israel, global marijuana marches, you name it. We just paid for so much entheogenesis. We paid for so many things, including things like Pot TV, which have used up almost $1 million in the last 5 years to promote. You know, we've had 10 million of our shows watched on the internet on Pot TV, to provide things like, well, you just name it. Anything that's been going on in North America, my money's been involved with it in the last 10 years. So it was a genius of an idea, overgrow the government by providing everybody who needed it with lots of pot they could grow at home and in their backyard. And then with the money we received from the sale of those seeds, we'd use it to basically infiltrate the democratic system, use it to our advantage to get people out of jails and liberate everyone, bring awareness to the public, and we have been amazingly successful. Since 1994, I want to point out that books and magazines about marijuana in 1994 were all illegal. Hemp stores were all illegal. Pipes and bongs were all illegal. There was no hemp industry even in existence in 1994, and medical marijuana was absolutely and most certainly illegal. So in the space of 10 years, when I've been very, very active working on all these things with many other activists, we've got a thriving hemp industry. We've got legal medical marijuana. We've got four magazines in the country about marijuana alone. Books and magazines are now legal due to the money that I spent on a court case in 1995 overturning the ban. Hemp stores are everywhere in the country. Pipes and bongs are everywhere in the country. And since 1994, from 26% of the public favoring legalization, we now have 57%. So the majority of Canadians agree. No one should go to jail for marijuana. The majority of Canadians agree, and yet the political establishment is shockingly lethargic in adopting what the public wants. And the reason for that specifically are two reasons. First of all, politicians love scapegoats because the purpose of government is to control what we think. It's about power indeed, and it's about power over the country and the citizens, and it's about restricting our ability to live our lives peacefully and honestly. And then the second thing is the United States government is a fundamentalist religious government, and they are big believers in making the sinners pay. And people who believe in marijuana, who are not members of the one-book dogmas, like the Bible or the Torah or the Book of the Law or the Quran, we are critical of authority. We question authority. And so the marijuana people have always been the most dangerous people for the modern theological states, like the United States, where conformity is the most valuable asset of any of its citizens, according to the government.
I think it's marijuana people are also the most dangerous for any group that wants to sort of control and have people follow a certain, you know,
idea. And when you smoke marijuana, of course, especially young people, you question your parents, you question your teachers, you question the authority of the police, you question the authority and legitimacy of the government. So in other words, every authority figure gets upset. That's why parents, even though they smoke lots of pot when they were young, don't like their own children smoking pot, because the kids immediately say, by what moral right do you have to tell me what to live, how to live? And then the kids say it to the teachers too. Everything you're teaching me is lies and bullshit, which it certainly is. Teachers can never admit they themselves took drugs or any of their experience about drugs. You know, teachers never explain to kids that we took this country over by, you know, forced extermination, ghettoization of the natives, robbing them, giving them diseases, and all the various very unsavory facts about how Canada and the United States actually became nations. It's a very sordid history of persecuting natives, persecuting the Chinese, persecuting immigrants, giving lots of money and power to the vested European Christian elite. And so you never really learn anything truthful in high school that's really of any use, that really tells you and would create cynicism about how our situation in Canada really got. I mean, why do we have marijuana laws for 70 years? I mean, what's been gained by criminalizing over a million Canadians with criminal records, putting hundreds of thousands of people in jail, you know, many of them for years? In the United States, millions of people have spent time in jail in the last 30 years for marijuana, and 750,000 are arrested every year in the United States. What have we benefited by this fabulous, huge persecution of a vicious and sadistic nature? There's absolutely nothing that people can point to that's any gain whatsoever. And when people say, well, we don't want to legalize yet another dangerous drug, well, you've already legalized all the dangerous substances, tobacco, alcohol, prescription drugs, guns, cars, fatty foods. They all kill people by the tens of thousands every year in North America, and they're all legal, and no one ever goes to jail for them. One of the things I point out is I face life imprisonment without parole in a United States jail, federal penitentiary, for doing something that no one in Canada has ever gone to jail for one day for. No one's ever gone to jail for selling seeds in Canada. The most that's happened to two people, myself and a fellow named Ian Hunter, is we got fines back in the 1990s and Ian Hunter in the year 2000 in Victoria. But otherwise, no one's ever gone to jail for selling seeds, and now all of a sudden, in a complete contrast, I face life imprisonment without parole in a U.S. federal penitentiary. If that isn't shocking to the conscience, I don't know what is. But furthermore, everybody in Canada knew what I was doing. You know, my money that I gave away, that $4 million, you know, it paid for incredible things. Jack Layton, the leader of the New Democratic Party of Canada, came to my home 18 months ago, almost 2 years ago, and filmed a wonderful interview for Pot TV right in my home, and Pot TV is paid for with my seed money. Mayor Larry, I mean, and my point is that the handlers of Jack Layton wouldn't let him come to my home if anybody thought for a second I was a drug dealer, for goodness sake. And I mean, Adrian Carr, the leader of the BC Green Party, took my money in 2002 to pay for the proportional representation petitioning drive that was going on then, because the Green Party didn't have enough money. I believed in it, and I gave her $7,000 in checks with my name on it and her name on it. Nobody was concerned about where that money came from. And Larry Campbell last year spoke at my conference I paid for called Beyond Prohibition 2004. And even the Justice Minister, the very Attorney General who signed off on this MLAT treaty to send me to the United States, Erwin Kotler, had his admitted 2 years ago on global TV, quite enthusiastically, that his children were big fans of Pot TV, that they watched it all the time, that they watched it more frequently than they read the Globe and Mail, and that basically admitted his kids were chronic. The Justice Minister's own children smoke marijuana, and here he is sending the very person they used to watch all the time on Pot TV to jail in a U.S. prison. So you know the pressure must be intense from Anne McClelland or the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and the White House. Clearly, I'm a hot commodity because I was very good at what I do, and we are getting the social change we're seeking. An American DEA, which gets a $2 billion budget, doesn't have any congressional oversight on how it spends it or behaves, is in the business of rounding up the cannabis culture, and as such, I am the leader of the forces allied against them. If they can destroy me and put me in a jail, and I assure you and your listeners that if I go to the United States, you'll never see me alive again, then they will have think they will have accomplished some very great destructive moment against our liberation culture and our very important revolution, a botanical revolution, a peaceful revolution to overgrow these governments, change their evil ways, and return our societies to one of peace, love, tolerance, where we appreciate the differences of people's peaceful and honest lifestyle and not persecute them.
So can you maybe outline for us, like, sort of the process that has happened to get the DEA in this country and stuff? Because I think a lot of people are quite amazed by...
DEA has offices in 65 nations around the world, and all those people do in those offices is keep track of people of each of those countries and who, what Americans they might come in contact with. But I'll give you an example of what the DEA is going to do if they get away with extraditing me. Every time they see an activist or a troublemaker of any kind that is threatening U.S. corporate interests, U.S. imperial interests, U.S. war interests, U.S. government interests, whether it's Halliburton's interest, where it's the oil industry's interest, whether it's the State Department's warlike aims, they find activists. And what they'll do is they'll come up to those people, a DEA agent or somebody, and ingratiate themselves. They've got lots of money, lots of time. They can go up to activists and have those DEA agents become friends of those activists, hang out with them for a few weeks or even a few months. They've got all the time in the world. And then, since most activists are short of money, it'll be easy to do, you'll just go up to an activist and say, listen, I don't want you to get this pot for me or anything like that, but, you know, I'd love to give you a couple $1,000 if you could just tell me who I could go to buy 10 or 20 pounds of pot so I could take it back to the United States. And so some activist says, you're going to give me $2,000 just to tell you where to go, because every activist in the marijuana, you know, field would know someone who's selling pot. So they just say, sure, I'll hook you up with that guy over there, and he'll be glad to sell you pot, right? Because there's like 400,000 people in Canada who grow pot and sell pot and broker pot. So, you know, you just have to go within 50 yards in any given direction, you're going to find someone who's selling pot. Well, once you do that, once you point someone in the direction, a DEA in the direction of someone who's selling pot to, at a person who claims they're American, taking it over the border, you become part of a conspiracy to export to the United States and liable to extradition. And, of course, America has crazy, insane punishments. They're a rogue government. They're totally out of the medieval period with their witch-burning type sentencing, so that a person like my friend Mike Smith in Oklahoma City last year in March 2004 was sentenced to 30 years in jail in Oklahoma for growing 200 plants, and his wife Yvonne Toy received 15 years in an Oklahoma federal penitentiary. 15 years, 30 years for the peaceful, honest lifestyle of growing marijuana. You're living in an insane, sick, medieval, twisted country, and it's important that everybody understand that the United States is an evil, rogue government, and we should, first of all, we have nothing to learn from the United States. We shouldn't cooperate them in any way above the most necessary economic things. We have everything they want. They have nothing we want. We have lumber, natural gas, oil, water, minerals, resources. This whole country is one big pot of gold for the Americans. And there isn't a single thing. I challenge people all the time. Name one thing that's made in America that Canada really needs. There's not a goddamn thing. We don't need anything about America. There's nothing to learn from America. It's a complete failure as a sovereign state. They don't provide for their own people. They're incompetent. They're crooked. They have wars against their own people and wars abroad. They are terrible with health care, terrible with schools, terrible with education. They can't save themselves when they have a natural disaster, and they are simply implicated in so much criminality around the world. We should put up a metaphorical brick wall between our country and theirs and let only good people from the United States into this country and be very, very careful about whatever American influences we let in, because they are a civilization that was once civil that is now in great decline, and we have nothing to learn from them. So I'm hoping my case can spur a renaissance in Canadian sovereignty in the belief that Canada is a superior way of life, a superior culture, and that our values are worth protecting.
How did the DEA get an office here? What purpose is it?
Well, the DEA's only purpose is to track people in Canada or British Columbia who are involved in the marijuana trade or the drug trade, as it would be called, the illegal drug trade, and who are having relationships with Americans. And failing that, you know, they're keeping an eye on all the legalization activity that goes here, and they're trying to stem it. They're trying to stop it from happening. The DEA's mandate is not just to go after drug distributors. It's to stop any kind of legalization efforts in any of these countries. And that involves doing, you know, like what they've been accused of doing in Venezuela, subverting the political process of these countries. And they're subverting our political process by trying to extradite someone like me, who's led this movement for over 10 years in Canada. And I would dare say I'm the worldwide acknowledged leader of our movement. So they're trying to chop the head off our movement by sending me back to the draconian and cruel punishments. You know, there's over 100,000 people in jails in the United States alone for marijuana. 100,000 people at any given time, many of them serving 5, 10, 15, 20-year life sentences for growing marijuana, for selling marijuana, for buying marijuana, for three strikes and you're out marijuana. And it is a barbaric regime. These prisons are terribly run, cruelly run. They're inadequately run. They're overcrowded. They have to build a new prison almost every couple of days in the United States just to keep up with the punishment fetish that the people who govern the United States are into. And of course, there's a reason for that. If you get a felony conviction to a marijuana grower, they can never vote in a federal election again and never throw the bastards out who've brought in this cruel regime. So it's all very political. It's all very fundamentally religious. It's all designed to appeal to the ignorant fundamentalists out there whose only ethic is to punish people who don't live like them.
Yeah. Okay, we have to take a quick break, 35 seconds and no longer, and we will be back with more from Mark Emery on Elephant Talk. Stay tuned.
And welcome back to Really Stupid, where we get people to do really stupid things. This week, we've been watching a man crawl across the Sahara Desert. How do you feel, Dave?
Thirsty camel.
He says he feels like a thirsty camel. Do camels get thirsty?
Juice. Falafel.
You just feel awful. I bet you'd like a nice glass of fresh squeezed pineapple juice. Oh, silly me. Look, I've spilt it all over the sand.
Don't let this happen to you. Rejuvenate yourself at the Thirsty Camel Cafe, number 14 Victoria Crescent in downtown Nanaimo.
Elephants can't talk, but these guys can. You're listening to Elephant Talk on CHLY 101.7.
That's right, folks. And we are speaking live via telephone with Mark Emery. Thanks for being here, Mark.
Sure.
So let's talk, for those that don't know, if you just joined us, Mark Emery has been selling marijuana seeds for the last 11 years, did you say?
Oh, yes, without question.
And from what I understand, the Canadian government is completely, has their eyes open. They're well aware of what you're doing. You paid thousands of dollars in taxes.
I paid $578,000 thereabouts in personal income taxes on my declarations, which clearly said I was a marijuana seed vendor. Income tax knew all about my business, where the banks were, where all my money went, how it was all spent, how everything was done. And they were glad to take this money, and they knew it was all from seeds, and they've known about it for years and years and years. In addition to which, every member of parliament had a subscription to my magazine that had my seed catalog. And I'm not saying they read it, but their assistants would have certainly got it. And my point being is that if anybody had ever had any objection to my selling seeds, they could have sent me a letter, given me a phone call, had the government issue a court order, made a complaint to the police. Never happened. I never got a single complaint in 11 years from any Canadian who ever said, I'm not down with this seed selling thing, or I don't think you should be doing that, and nobody ever refused my money. Adrian Carr didn't refuse my money. Jack Layton didn't refuse my money. They didn't refuse to appear on my media. Larry Campbell didn't refuse to come to this conference. Irwin Kotler went out of his way to point out that his kids loved pot TV. Everybody in Canada knew what I was doing, took my money, was glad to have it, and understood what my role was in society, and understood that I was a good guy advocating peaceful democratic change over a cruel and inhumane system. Canadians know American justice is is barbaric. You do meet the people that say, oh, we need to be tough on crime and punish people more, but that's not really the Canadian way. Canadians aren't big into punishment. Canadians are into tolerance, respect, politeness, good comedy, and things like that, and justice issues. That's why everywhere we go in the world, people welcome Canadians. No one shoots at Canadians. No one kidnaps Canadians. No one bars Canadians from their country. Even our peacekeepers are always welcome and very rarely killed by even people who we call them our enemies. People are very reluctant to ever hurt a Canadian or impugn a Canadian. Americans are loathed and despised around the world for a good reason. Their governments are creating hatred everywhere and every day. They behave on behalf of this dominator culture, this punishment culture.
Now, at some point, though, the American authorities said to Canadian authorities, hey, we want you to send this guy here so we can try him. Is that correct?
Well, of course, yeah. And the Canadian police are very compliant in this way. And the reason for that is that Canadian police are the only people that are always advocating for more of the prohibition. Canadians are always saying, judges don't give enough punishment. And in fact, in a treasonous manner, the Solicitor General of British Columbia, formerly Richard Coleman and now John Less, are often saying, oh, well, Canadian courts won't give proper punishment. Which, by the way, is treason, because the Solicitor General is sworn to uphold Canadian law and the Canadian Charter of Rights. And so what they have done in the case of the people who tunneled under the border and took marijuana, is the Solicitor General, John Less, said, well, I'm glad they got caught on the American side because those people will punish them a lot more. Well, that's total treason. What you're supposed to do is, unless you have contempt of court for Canadian law, which the Solicitor General obviously does, it's totally illegal for him to say that Canadian courts don't give proper punishment. He's supposed to respect and uphold what the Canadian courts come, not criticize it. He's supposed to uphold Canadian jurisprudence and what. And if he doesn't have confidence in the Canadian jury system, the Canadian court system, and Canadian law, then he should resign. But, of course, what he does is he's let his police cooperate with the U.S., knowing full well that I would not see Canadian law, not see a Canadian judge, not see a Canadian jury, and not be even judge. Like, I don't get a trial in Canada. I just get a hearing. A hearing has almost no threshold of evidentiary, you know, toughness, right? I mean, just if they comply with a few treaties and off I go and I'm gone, and that's the last anyone will ever see to me. I'll surely be murdered in a U.S. prison or eke out a meager existence there before I die in jail in the United States. All, again, to remind people for something that no one has ever gone to jail for in Canada, ever, in the 35 years seeds have been illegal. Virtually no one gets prosecuted, and of the two people that have been prosecuted, they got fines. So what I face first, somewhere around March, will be an extradition hearing, where a judge will be asked to commit me to extradition. And then, after, if we lose that, we are committed to extradition, we go through a political process whereby Canadians can save me and save me from going to the United States by appealing to the Justice Minister of Canada, if that's Erwin Kotler at the time, or whoever is the Justice Minister. And the Justice Minister holds all the cards. They can cancel the extradition. They can charge me in Canada for the same things if they want, or they can agree to the extradition. And then after that phase, if we are committed to extradition still by the Justice Minister, we can appeal to the BC Court of Appeal. And if we lose the BC Court of Appeal, then we're doomed. I'm doomed. And there I go, never to be seen from again for something, like I say, in Canada no one's ever gone to jail with, and that no one in 11 years, from politicians to the public, ever condemned me for doing. I never met a person on the street. I have a listed phone number. I was accessible every day. I ran for election like 6 times, twice for mayor, twice for federal parliament, twice for provincial parliament. Nobody ever came to me and said, I don't like what you do. I think you're an evil man, and nobody ever said things like that. All around the world, people were grateful for my money. They thought I was perhaps the best activist in our movement ever because I selflessly, really, devoted all my money to it. I never kept any of it. I never bought a car for myself. I never had stocks and bonds, offshore accounts, assets. I never saved any of this money. People say, well, for a guy who made lots of money, you didn't save anything. Isn't that stupid? And I said, no. The whole purpose of this botanical revolution, this overgrowing the government, was not so I could have money and live well. The purpose was to raise money so we could fund elections and politicians and conferences and rallies and magazines and media and get the word out and overthrow this evil system that has been imposed upon us, where our people go to jail in record numbers in cruel ways for no reason whatsoever. That was the purpose of everything, and Canadians appreciated that.
So I want to ask you a few questions about extradition now. I'm sure you've done a bit of research on it, but can the United States government ask the Canadian government to extradite a citizen for any reason? I mean, this seems...
Well, theoretically, it has to be something that's punishable by jail here. So, you know, selling seeds theoretically is punishable by jail, but no one's ever gone to jail. No judge has ever thought it was serious enough, because there's no drug quality to a seed. There's no drug in a seed. It just becomes a plant that the United States is determined fanatically to exterminate, and to exterminate all the people who believe in that plant. When you've got 100,000 people in jail for a peaceful, honest lifestyle like growing marijuana, you're involved in a massive persecution pogrom. You're involved in the most medieval of tortures, where you take people culturally for something they're doing peacefully and honestly, and putting them in jail, taking them away from their families, their children, all the people who love them, and creating misery and agony, causing billions of dollars to be spent merely for the purpose of punishing
these
people.
It's like a type of political prisoner.
Well, of course they're political prisoners. Everybody who's in jail for peaceful drug use is a political prisoner. There is nothing that would ever require the criminal justice system to punish people for plants or drugs or any personal honest lifestyle, just like there's no reason to punish people who leave the U.S. Army because they object to the war in Iraq. You know, the funny thing about that, let me just digress. I'm going to the Bush protest today, the war in Iraq and the Bush protests at the Vancouver Art Gallery today, downtown at 2 o'clock, and I just want to point out that the people who've deserted the U.S. Army to protest the war in Iraq face jail time. Now, to me, there's no job on this planet where you're not allowed to quit at any time if you don't like how it's going. Anybody, you can quit any contract or any job and say, listen, I'm not going to take any more money from you, and I object to what's going on here. I'm quitting. There's not a job in the world where you can't quit, except in the U.S. Army, inexplicably. So you have to put up with horrifying, you know, injustices, shooting kids, blowing up families, strafing wedding parties, and all sorts of immoral activities, but you can't quit that. You can't leave the U.S. Army. And I think that is always extremely bizarre, because people need to be able to make moral decisions at any point in their career regarding any job they're involved in. If your job demands that you do unethical, evil things, you should have the right to quit that. And so it's very interesting that only when it comes to the U.S. Army are you not allowed to quit. And yet the U.S. Army has committed immoral atrocities for decades in Vietnam and places around the world. The United States is always involved in subverting and murdering civilians. Billions and people all around the world. And rarely, unlike, say, the Canadians, do they actually help people. So I find it very interesting that in the Vietnam War, we welcomed people who were war resistors, conscientious objectors, and we made a home for them, and that the Canadian government is under such pressure from the U.S. government that we have not yet done that for the people who object to an equally immoral war, perhaps even more immoral, and that we ourselves as a nation do not support, neither the people nor our government, but we haven't made accommodation for all these war resistors from the war in Iraq. It shows you the tremendous pressure the United States puts on Canada, that they don't put on other countries, even though we, again, as I repeat, are invaluable to the United States. Without us, it's no lumber, it's no gas, it's no oil, and they need our oil, and they need our natural gas, and they need that lumber now, and they need our water, and they need our mineral resources. In fact, they need everything, and they need our comedians, for goodness sake, to keep them, you know, from being totally stressed out and getting a sense of doom because their nation is going through a crisis of confidence now. They need everything about Canada, we need nothing about them, and yet we are clearly, our government is under the spell of this Bush regime in a most bizarre and unseemly way.
Okay, let's talk a little about, I've heard mention of something called the drug kingpin legislation.
Yes, well actually I would be the first person who qualifies for the death penalty under that, and if I was in America, they would probably try and give me the death penalty. But because they can't extradite someone by saying they'll give you the death penalty, they have simply not admitted they do that. But we're looking, sentencing guidelines would, if they can't give me the death penalty, would mean I would certainly get 17 to 21 years for the selling of the marijuana seeds and being part of a conspiracy to have people make marijuana out of it. And then the drug laundering, which is really bizarre. Drug laundering is just, I spent the money I got, obviously, and did great things with it, of which I'm very, very proud of, and will be glad to boast about all the incredible events, hundreds and hundreds of events and people and court cases and trials and media that I gave the money to. That's considered money laundering. So I'd be looking at around 31 years in jail in the United States after my very unfair federal court, you know, trial would take place and see Seattle, I would be, you know, spending, I would get longer time in a U.S. jail than you'd get for multiple murder in Canada. The most you can get for murder in Canada is 25 years, and I would get more than that. Just like my friend Mike Smith in Oklahoma got 30 years. He got more for growing 200 marijuana plants in Oklahoma than you'll get for murder, multiple murder in Canada. That shows you how sick America's become, and how diseased it's become, and how, like a cancer, we should isolate it and keep it well away from us. Now, I must tell you that most Americans are opposed to the Bush regime. Most Americans understand that they're involved in a cruel fetish of rounding up the marijuana people and filling up the jails. So we have to set a good example here in Canada in order to liberate our American cousins. You know, Canada's always been a great example for the United States. We ended slavery 60 years earlier than the United States. We ended alcohol prohibition earlier than the United States. We were in a just war, World War II, 2.5 years before the United States, and they had to be dragged into it. We stayed out of the immoral wars, like the war in Iraq and the war in Vietnam. We've always sent a good example around the world as what peacekeepers are really like and what they can really do to help people. We were there when Hurricane Katrina, our emergency rescue people, were there before the National Guard even got into New Orleans. Our people had already cleaned up, saved 50 people's lives, and got out already. We gave women the vote first. We have done all these great things. Ken Taylor helped them get out of the Iran hostage crisis in 1980. We gave lots of money to them after 9/11. We're always there to help our American friends and set a good example. And we continue to set a good example when we let war resistors come here, when we do modernize our marijuana laws and give an example that we don't believe in prisons. Canadians don't build a lot of new prisons. We don't have a lot of, we don't have the prison mentality. We have 6 times fewer people per capita in jails than the United States is, because they are a holy roller fundamentalist kind of nation that believes in making the sinners pay with extreme and severe punishments, very much like the Inquisition or the medieval periods. They still haven't gotten through this terrible immaturity that has been a descendant from the Christian European methods of punishing people, like whether it was the Jews in Europe in the Middle Ages, or the Native Americans, or the Black Africans. All these people were victims of Christian European persecution, and we continue to, unfortunately, suffer under this terrible legacy that the Americans, by and large, are responsible for in this modern era. So it's important for Canadians to celebrate their Canadianness, and enhance it, and to make sure that the American influence is a very dangerous and pernicious influence, and we must keep it well away from us.
Now, Mark, are you the only person in the world that is selling marijuana seeds on the internet?
Oh, no. There's at least 50 Canadian companies now have been selling for years. In fact, they were selling on the street. I've been selling in downtown Vancouver since the year 2002 and back in the 90s. But there have been people who've been selling nonstop for 10 years in downtown Vancouver who've not been charged. Nobody's been charged.
So if
even I'm not charged.
If they were to extradite you, would it not follow that they should extradite all these other people as well?
First of all, that would be bad. We don't want to wish that on anybody. But that's not going to happen.
No, of course not. I don't think you'll be extradited either. I think it's just ludicrous.
Well, let's hope you're right. But I don't want people to be complacent about thinking that that's going to happen just because it's so obnoxious a thought. That, you know, why would we send a good exemplary Canadian like myself to a certain gulag death in the United States? I'll tell you, complacency will allow that to happen. Because the government presumes that if people don't make a noise, if people don't threaten really substantial political damage to the governing body, that this will just simply happen, because money and power are the coin of the realm in government. Sure, they listen to opinion polls. Sure, they occasionally do things that they think people want. But mostly government's all about social control. It's all about power and influence. It's all about, after all, Paul Martin's own businesses are registered as Panamanian businesses. He doesn't believe in being Canadian. He believes in being a corporate citizen of the business world. So it's important to understand who you're dealing with. You're dealing with a person like Anne McClellan, Minister of Public Safety. She's like Darth Vader incarnate. Like, she's like Emily Murphy. She's from the same riding that Emily Murphy came from, the woman who was a white supremacist, who brought in the marijuana laws, who brought in the eugenics laws, and all these kind of terrible things. We've got some evil people in government, and it's important to either vote them out of office or overwhelm them with so much dissent that they cannot help but do the right thing. That requires a great deal of energy focused on politics, and that's something that typically a lot of young people, and many of your listeners probably, are not doing, and we're going to have to do that. If I'm to be saved, I'll be saved by the Canadian people,
and
that means they have to get involved.
And how do they get involved? Like,
It's very important to join a political party. Political parties have a lot of influence, and people, individuals within those political parties, if they go to meetings, if they make it known, can have a lot of influence. Now, I would typically say people should vote for the NDP, but if they they get involved with the Liberal Party or the Conservative Party, that's useful too. It, whatever ideology that people feel most comfortable with, they should go to those meetings, and then they should talk it up with people who are like them or feel as them about why prohibition is wrong, why prohibition punishes people, why prohibition aggrandizes organized crime, why prohibition creates a police state, wiretapping, more police than you need, why it creates crime, why it creates, you know, legalizing marijuana through a tax and regulated system would solve so many of our social problems. It would end a lot of the violation of our civil rights. It would make sure marijuana is sold under a regulated environment to the appropriate people of appropriate age. The government would collect GST and PST. Policing would be much less required. The drug war would virtually be over, because once you legalize marijuana, there really aren't a lot of enough drugs out there to justify having a drug war, which of course is why police don't want to end prohibition, because they get good jobs from it. A war on drugs goes on forever. Unlike other social problems which you can solve, a war on drugs never is solved. It never is won, because people will always want to take drugs. Millions and millions and millions of people, including young people, will always want to experiment with drugs of every different possible kind. And all the propaganda that the government wages about people not using drugs will not work. It never works. Curiosity is a fundamental human value, a human element, and people, when they feel they need some of these drugs, whatever their reason is, and people always find some reason, they're going to want to find these things. Criminalizing them, putting them in jail, using criminal law against them is wrong, 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 and is totally contradictory to any kind of social good. Nothing good comes of it. Putting people in jail because of poor choices they made about their own health is insane. That's not why the only reason we have the criminal justice system is to restrain those who would endanger our property, our children, or our personal safety. Mm. And if that's not going to happen, then we don't use the criminal justice system for those people.
And so I have like kind of a twofold question. One is, I guess the DEA is targeting you, and the legal way in which they're targeting you is because you sell seeds to the U.S.?
Well, there's 50 other people in Canada that sell seeds to the U.S., and seeds are even legal in England and Holland and lots of places where they are sold anyway to Americans. So, and they can't be extradited. Because seeds are legal in England and Holland, for example, those people can't be extradited because the law has to exist in both countries. But typically, the punishment for any kind of marijuana-related act is so severe in the United States compared to any other country in Europe or compared to Canada or anywhere except, say, Asia, where they have the same crazy dominator mentality there of, you know, making the sinners pay. And, you know, Asia is not a continent where they've developed a sophisticated civil rights environment. So a lot of those places have virtual dictatorships. And so they get severe punishments for marijuana in those countries, too. There's 22 countries around the world that you can get the death penalty for marijuana. And then there's places like the United States where people by the tens of thousands get life imprisonment or 10, 20 years in jail for marijuana. You know, people typically don't serve. The longest serving prisoner in Canada for marijuana was Rosie Robotham, who spent 18 years in Canadian federal penitentiaries for 3 hashish importing cases that affected him from 1970s to the 1980s. So typically the most someone would get would be to serve, you know, 5 to 6 years tops in a Canadian federal penitentiary for the biggest and most massive of, say, marijuana operations, where you'd be doing zillions of dollars perhaps. But typically we don't believe in sending people to jail for marijuana because it's not productive. There's no purpose to it. Why would you do that? People who grow marijuana are by and large good people. I've met thousands and thousands of people who grow marijuana. I've been into more grow rooms in Canada than any other person alive. And I can tell you that they're virtually all wonderful people, mothers, fathers, you know, parents, brothers, good people, neighbors, that, you know, don't pose any harm to anybody. And when people point out things that do create harm, like, ooh, indoor marijuana growing gardens, I point out that, hey, they only exist because of prohibition. The government literally manufactures that situation and then holds the marijuana people responsible for the occasional irresponsible person who might grow indoors. But if marijuana were legal, we'd be growing it in our backyards, we'd be growing it on big farms and greenhouses. People don't grow legal products typically indoors. Young people will do anything you tell them not to do. Like, the more we tell our young people don't smoke marijuana, I mean, 80% of all teenagers will smoke pot. Well, you really can't get higher than that. You know, the number of people who will become chronic users of pot who are young people, say under 20, are probably only about 20%. You know, when I had four boys, and they're all adults now, but one of the things they always wanted to do is they wanted to drink a beer at age 14, and they wanted to get my car keys and drive the car down the driveway, right? You know, there's certain things that all young people do, and we've got to be careful not to say, don't do this, or I'll punish you if you do this, is to have a good talk with them about, you know, the first thing you want to do if your kids want to drink alcohol is walk down and see some alcoholics throwing up, or let them be exposed to the excesses of alcohol so that they understand up close the very unglamorous consequences of improper and excessive consumption. And this would be true with any drugs. I would say, you know, here's the thing. Drug addiction, anyway, is not about substances. It's about psychic wounds. Everybody, when I treat, I had a drug addiction clinic. We spent $200,000 on the iboga therapy. I was here in Vancouver. And one of the things I learned treating patients, we treated 65 people over a two-year period. And of those 65 people, 60 of those people I treated did not have their biological father in their life for all or part of their childhood. It was a remarkable discovery that these people were all addicted to drugs because of the rejection, the alienation, and the simple lack of any parental guidance from their father in their childhood. And right after puberty, they started making bad decisions with who they were hanging out with, what drugs they were taking, and they became hellions, you know, and they became real problems. Drugs have nothing to do with addiction. That's just the final stage in them trying to deal with their psychic wounds.
It's a symptom.
Yeah. It's very much a symptom. They could be addicted. I've never met everybody who's got an addiction to food, who's obese, everyone who's got addiction to cigarettes, alcohol, drugs of any kind. Anybody who shows any self-destructive tendencies is dealing with childhood alienation and childhood trauma. I have never yet to this day, and I ask everybody who's got any kind of addictive tendency where they grew up and how they grew up, I've never met anybody that grew up and told me, oh no, my parents loved me, they were always great, they told me that I was so wanted and they were always there.
All right.
You know, and what happens is they never say, oh, when I went to a party when I was 18 and inexplicably I just started developing a heroin addict or habit. Never happens. You never see people who grew up in loving, well-adjusted homes with two parents who clearly care about these people. Those people don't get addicted to things. I found that, you know, typically if you have a wonderful childhood with two loving parents, and that's surprisingly rarer and rarer these days. A lot of people come from group homes. A lot of people come from broken families. A lot of people have come from single-parent families. All these people, I'm not saying will become drug addicted, but they are extremely vulnerable to addictive tendencies because they grow up seeing other children with a father, and that father loves them, and he's there for them, and he takes them places and does stuff like that. And it's a regular thing that those young people can count on. And they're aware that they don't have that. And that makes them feel bad. That makes them feel alienated. It makes them feel like they're less important, less special. And so they grow up with this missing thing, this inadequacy, this alienation. And you know what? You grew up for 15, 16 years of your childhood without a father. That's an incredible burden and challenge all at the same time. And, you know, I myself know nothing of that because my parents were home every day of my life. My dad made a point of throwing the baseball to me every day for 20 minutes. He told me he loved me and that I was going to go places. I never saw him raise his hand to my mother ever. He never raised his voice to her. He drank one beer at hockey night in Canada every week, and that's all I ever saw. And he was just a fabulous guy, and my mom was always great, and they were always there. And so I like to think that I don't have any addictive tendencies, that there is nothing that I'm doing that's a self-destructive impulse that's based on an inadequacy I feel inside. And that's what you're dealing with. You know, people often come to you, people just want to get high. You're justifying people get high. But you know what? I've never met an addict that's having fun. I've never met someone who drinks excessively or smokes cigarettes excessively or is eating excessively and getting fat. I've never met anybody who's a heroin user or a cocaine user that's really happy with things. They're not having fun. The people who are having fun are the people who are clearly in love with themselves and like everything about their life and are happy with the direction they're going and feel good about existence. And if you feel good about existence, you're not a drug addict. Right? And so it's very clear that people are using drugs and eating and cigarettes and all these things and prescription drugs as a way of dealing with childhood trauma. And we have to develop a new understanding of that so that we can appropriately say, well, what then should we do when people are hooked on crystal methamphetamine? Should we start going and rounding people up and giving them life sentences, which is what you hear nowadays? Or should we understand the nature of their addiction and how it's hurting themselves? After all, the principal people who addiction hurts are the addicts themselves. So why is our impulse to put people in prison or to jail people or to bring in prohibition, which makes everything much worse and creates a massive criminal class to have to handle things? One of the things I always worry about when marijuana is illegal is that we are making jobs for tens of thousands of young people in the drug marijuana industry Well, we shouldn't have to. If marijuana were legal and sold in stores, and sold at a legal rate at its appropriate low value, then there would be no lucrative profits involved in marijuana, and yet young people wouldn't be attracted to it. So when people tell me that they want prohibition, they want marijuana to remain illegal, I'm saying, well, you know, you're really creating tens of thousands of jobs for young teenagers then to sell drugs, to sell marijuana, because they're going to make a lot more selling marijuana than they are getting $6 an hour at McDonald's, which is what the pay at McDonald's is when you're 16, 17, 18. So by making a prohibitionary environment, we are literally helping young people join gangs and organize crime by making it so attractive to them that they can't resist. Because what young people would, you know, oh, you can work at McDonald's for $6 an hour, or you can take this package of white powder across town and I'll give you $500, right? I mean, those kind of things to a young person are, wow, glamour, outlaw behavior, big money. You know, I can impress women, I can get a car, I can have nice clothes, I can have social status because of this money.
Mm-hmm.
Prohibition is very corrupting to young people and old people. But it's young people that are usually getting caught, and it's usually when they get a criminal record, it damages their ability to get an education, to move ahead, to go over borders, to get jobs in policing, banking, and a variety of other occupations. And if their lives, the doors are shut on their lives so early, they may never recover from that. So prohibition creates a lot of collateral damage to our young people, as well as our civil liberties, our social system generally, and rewards all the wrong instincts. It rewards punishment and not tolerance. We should always be rewarding tolerance. We should always be thinking about how can we help people, not how can we hurt people.
We are out of time, Mark.
You know, I would love to keep you on.
But could you just, we've got about, a minute left. Can you tell us how, what can people do? Who should they contact? Can they write letters Irwin Cutler?
They can write letters to Irwin Cutler. And I believe in my heart that Irwin Cutler doesn't want to send us away. He knows this would stain his entire career. He has a remarkable resume as a human rights activist before he came into Parliament. I'm sure he regrets being Justice Minister. It's a thankless job. He's not able to really put forward any productive reformist arguments. You know, he's in the same cabinet as evil people like Anne McClellan and corporatists like Paul Martin, and, you know, and so he's in a very inhospitable environment for someone who comes from the background he does of a human rights activist. But we should write him letters.
Mm-hmm.
We should go to our website, cannabisculture.com, and try and give money to our legal defense. It requires a fortune and money to pay for our lawyers, and we're having a great struggle being able to do that. I want people to write to their members of parliament, talk, and join political parties. Get involved in the campaign to save me from being extradited. And more importantly than saving my ass is to legalize marijuana. Marijuana, because we have to set an example for the world in Canada. We can do that. We did that with gay marriage. We've done that with resisting immoral wars like in Iraq and Vietnam. We've always led the way, ending slavery, ending alcohol prohibition. We can lead the way and end marijuana prohibition, serve as a good example to the world community like we always have in Canada, and accomplish something much greater and bigger than merely saving me from extradition. We can achieve great social change to benefit millions and millions of Canadians and Americans in the years to come, and that's such a wonderful dream.
Right on. Well, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah,
and the best of luck to you.
And thank you.
We will be in touch in the next weeks and months.
Yeah, and we'll be updating people on your situation.
And I'll be glad to assist you in any way.
Excellent. Well, thanks again.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay.
Have a good afternoon.
Bye-bye.